Well, that it makes the heterosexual jump a lot more easily than B. It's evidently a hardier version of our old friend.
Has CDC quantified that yet? Kathy asked.
No, they need a few more months. At least that's what I heard a couple weeks ago.
How bad? Altman asked.
Working with Surgeon was turning into an educational experience.
Ralph Forster went over 5 years ago to see how bad things were. Know the story, Alex?
Not all of it, just the bottom line.
Ralph flew over on a government ticket, official trip and all that. And first thing happens off the plane, the Thai official meets him at customs, walks him to the car and says, "Want some girls for tonight?" That's when he knew there was a real problem.
"I believe it," Alex said, remembering when he would have smiled and nodded. This time he managed not to shudder. "The numbers are grim. Mr. Altman, right now nearly a third of the kids inducted into the Thai Army are HIV positive, mainly E strain." The implications of that number were unmistakable.
"A third? A third of them?"
"Up from 25% when Ralph flew over. That's a hard number, okay?"
"But that means..." "It might mean in 50 years no more Thailand," Kathy announced in a matter-of-fact voice that masked her inner horror. "When I was going to school here, I thought oncology was the place to be for the super-smart ones." She pointed for Altman's benefit. "Marty, Bert, Kurt, and Louise. Those guys in the corner over there. I didn't think I could take it, take the stress. So I cut up eyeballs and fix 'em. I was wrong. We're going to beat cancer. But these damned viruses, I don't know."
"The solution, Kathy, is in understanding the precise interactions between the gene strings in the virus and the host cell. And it shouldn't be all that hard. Viruses are such tiny little sons of bitches. They can only do so many things, not like the interaction of the entire human genome at conception. Once we figure that one out, we can defeat all the little bastards."
Alexander, like most research docs, was an optimist.
"So, researching the human cell?" Altman asked, interested in learning this.
Alexander shook his head.
"A lot smaller than that. We're into the genome now. It's like taking a strange machine apart. Every step you're trying to figure what the individual parts do. And sooner or later you got all the parts loose, and you know where they all go, and then you figure out what they all do in a systematic way. That's what we're doing now."
"You know what it's going to come down to?" Kathy suggested with a question, then answered it.
"Mathematics." "Well, that's what Gus says down at Atlanta."
"Math? Wait a minute," Altman objected.
"At the most basic level, the human genetic code is composed of 4 amino acids labeled A, C, G, and T. How those letters, the acids I mean, are strung together determines everything," Alex explained. "Different character sequences mean different things and interact in different ways. And probably Gus is right. The interactions are mathematically defined. The genetic code really is a code. It can be cracked, and it can be understood."
"Probably someone will assign a mathematical value to them. Complex polynomials," he thought. "Was that important?"
"Just nobody smart enough to do it has come along yet," Kathy Ryan observed. "That's the home run ball, Roy. Some day somebody is going to step up to the plate and put that one over the fence, and it will give us the key to defeating all human diseases. All of them. Every single one. The pot of gold at the end of that rainbow is medical immortality. And, who knows, maybe human immortality."
"Put us all out of business, especially you, Kathy. One of the first things they'll edit out of the human genome is myopia and diabetes and that..."
"It'll unemploy you before it unemploys me, Professor," Kathy said with an impish smile. "I'm a surgeon, remember? I still have trauma to fix. But sooner or later, you're going to win your battle."
"But would it be in time for this morning's E-strain patient?" Alex wondered.
"Probably not. Probably not."
She was cursing them now, mainly in French, but Flemish also. The army medics didn't understand either language. Maudi spoke the former well enough to know that, vile as the imprecations were, they were not the product of a lucid mind. The brain was now being affected,
and John Baptiste was unable to converse even with her God. Her heart was under attack, finally, and that gave the doctor hope that death would come for her and show some belated mercy for a woman who deserved far more than she had received from life. Maybe delirium was a blessing for her. Maybe her soul was detached from her body. Maybe in not knowing where she was, who she was, what was wrong, the pain didn't touch her anymore, not in the places that mattered. It was an illusion the doctor needed, but if what he saw was mercy, it was a ghastly variety of it. The patient's face was a mass of rashes now, almost as though she'd been brutally beaten, her pale skin like an opaque window onto misplaced blood. He couldn't decide if her eyes were still working. There was bleeding both on the surface and the interior of each, and if she could still see, it wouldn't last much longer. They'd almost lost her half an hour earlier, occasioning his rush to the treatment room to see her choking on aspirated vomit, and the medics trying both to clear her airway and keep their gloves intact. The restraints that held her in place, coated though they were with smooth plastic, had abraded away her skin, causing more bleeding and more pain. The tissues of her vascular system were breaking down as well, and the IV leaked as much out on the bed as went into the arms and legs, all of the fluids as deadly as the most toxic poison. Now the medical corpsmen were truly frightened even of touching the patient, gloves or not, suits or not. Moody saw that they'd gotten a plastic bucket and filled it with dilute iodine. And as he watched, one of them dipped his gloves into it, shaking them off but not drying them, so that if he touched her, there would be a chemical barrier against the pathogens that might leap at him from her body. Such precautions weren't necessary. The gloves were thick. But he could hardly blame the men for their fear. At the turning of the hour, the new shift arrived, and the old one left. One of them looked back on his way out the door, praying with silent lips that Allah would take the woman before he had to come back in 8 hours. Outside the room, an Iranian army doctor similarly dressed in plastic would lead the men to the disinfection area, where their suits would be sprayed before they took them off, and then their bodies, while the suits were burned to ashes in the downstairs incinerator. Maudi had no doubts that the procedures would be followed to the letter. No, they would be exceeded in every detail, and even then the medics would be afraid for days to come. Had he possessed a deadly weapon right then and there, he might have used it on her, and to hell with the consequences. A large injection of air might have worked a few hours before, causing a fatal embolism, but the breaking of her vascular system was such that he couldn't even be sure of that. It was her strength that made the ordeal so terrible. Small though she was, she'd worked 40 years of long hours, and earned surprisingly good health as a result. The body which had sustained her courageous soul for so long would not give up the battle, futile as it was.
"Come, Moody, you know better than this," the director said behind him.
"What do you mean?" he asked, without turning.
"If she were back in the hospital in Africa, what would be different? Would they not treat her the same way, taking the same measures to sustain her? The blood, and the IV fluids, and everything else, it would be exactly the same. Our religion does not allow euthanasia. If anything, the care here is better," he pointed out correctly, if coldly, then turned away to check the chart. 5 liters. Excellent.
"We could start."
"No." The director shook his head. "When her heart stops, we will drain all her blood. We will remove the liver, kidneys, and spleen, and then our real work begins."
"Someone should at least pray for her soul."
"You will, Moody. You are a fine doctor. You care even for an infidel. You may be proud of that. If it were possible to save her, you would have done so. I know that. You know that. She knows that.
What we are doing to inflict this on...
On unbelievers," the director reminded him. "On those who hate our country and our faith, who spit upon the words of the prophet. I will even agree that this is a woman of virtue. Allah will be merciful with her, I am sure. You did not choose her fate. Neither did I."
He had to keep Moody going,
The younger man was a brilliant physician, if anything, too good. The director, for his part, thanked Allah that he'd spent the last decade in laboratories, else he might have succumbed to the same human weaknesses. Badrine insisted. This time, three generals. Every seat full, and one of them with two small children strapped in together. They understood now. They had to. He'd explained it to them, pointing to the tower, whose controllers had watched every flight in and out, and who had to know what was going on by now, and arresting them would do little good, as their families would miss them, and if their families were picked up, the neighbors would know, wouldn't they? Well, yes, they had agreed. Just send a damned airliner next time, he wanted to tell Tehran. But no, someone would have objected, here or there, it didn't matter, because no matter what you said, no matter how sensible it was, somebody would object to it. Whether on the Iranian side or the Iraqi, that didn't matter either. Either way, it would get people killed. It certainly would. There was nothing for him to do but wait now. Wait and worry. He could have had a few drinks, but he decided against it. He'd had alcohol more than once. All those years in Lebanon. As Bahrain still was, Lebanon had been, and probably would be again, a place where the strict Islamic rules could be violated. And there he had indulged in Western vice along with everyone else. But not now. He might be close to death, and, sinner or not, he was a Muslim, and he would face death in the proper way. And so he drank coffee for the most part, staring out the windows from his seat, next to the phone, telling himself that the caffeine was making his hand shake, and nothing else. "You're Jackson?" Tony Brentano asked. He'd spent the morning with the acting chiefs. Now it was time for the worker bees. "Yes, sir, J3. I guess I'm your operations officer," Robbie replied, taking his seat and not, for once, carrying a bundle of papers and scurrying around like the white rabbit. "How bad is it?"
"Well, we're spread pretty thin. We still have two carrier battle groups in the I.O. looking after India and Sri Lanka. We're flying a couple battalions of light infantry to the Marianas to reassert control there and supervise the withdrawal of Japanese personnel. That's mainly political. We don't expect any problems. Our forward-deployed air assets have been recalled to CONUS to refit. That aspect of operations against Japan went well."
"You will want me to speed production of the F-22 and restart B-2 production, then? That's what the Air Force said."
"We just proved that the stealth is one hell of a force multiplier, Mr. Secretary, and that's a fact. We need all of those we can get."
"I agree. What about the rest of the force structure?" Brentano asked.
"We're too damned thin for all the commitments we have. If we had to go to Kuwait again, for example, like we did in 1991, we can't do it. We literally do not have all that force to project anymore. You know what my job is, sir. I have to figure out how to do the things we have to do. Okay, operations against Japan took us as far as we could go, and
Mickey Moore said a lot of nice things about the plan you put together and executed," the SecDef pointed out.
"General Moore is very kind." "Yes, sir, it worked. But we were on a shoestring the whole time, and that's not the way American forces are supposed to go out into harm's way, Mr. Secretary. We're supposed to scare the bejeebers out of people the moment the first private steps off the airplane. I can improvise if I have to, but that's not supposed to be my job. Sooner or later I goof, or somebody goofs, and we end up with dead people in uniform."
"I agree with that, too."
Brentano took a bite of his sandwich.
"The President's given me a free hand to clean this department out, do things my way. I have 2 weeks to put the new force requirements together."
2 weeks, sir?
If Jackson were able to go pale, that would have done it to him.
"Jackson, how long you been in uniform?" the SecDef asked.
"Counting time at the trade school, call it 30 years.
"If you can't do it by tomorrow, you're the wrong guy. But I'll give you 10 days, Brentano said generously.
"Mr. Secretary, I'm operations, not manpower, and
"Exactly.
In my way of looking at things, manpower fills the needs that operations defines. Decisions in a place like this are supposed to be made by the shooters, not the accountants. That's what was wrong at TRW when I moved in. Accountants were telling engineers what they could have to be engineers. No.
Brentano shook his head.
That didn't work. If you build things, your engineers decide how the company runs. For a place like this, the shooters decide what they need, and the accountants figure out how to shoehorn it into the budget. There's always a struggle, but the product end of the business makes the decisions.
Well, damn.
Jackson managed not to smile.
Parameters?
Figure the largest credible threat, the most serious crisis that's likely, not possible, and design me a force structure that can handle it. Even that wasn't good enough, and both men knew it. In the old days, there had been the guideline of 2.5 wars, that America could deploy to fight 2 major conflicts, plus a little brush fire somewhere else. Few had ever admitted that this rule had always been a fantasy, all the way back to the Eisenhower presidency. Today, as Jackson had just admitted, America lacked the wherewithal to conduct a single major military deployment. The fleet was down to half of what it had been 10 years earlier. The Army was down further. The Air Force, ever sheltering behind its high-tech, was formidable, but had still retired nearly half its total strength. The Marines were still tough and ready, but the Marine Corps was an expeditionary force, able to deploy in the expectation that reinforcements would arrive behind them, and dangerously light in its weapons. The cupboard wasn't exactly bare, but the enforced diet hadn't really done anyone much good.
10 days?
You've got what I need sitting in a desk drawer right now, don't you? Planning officers always did, Brentano knew.
Give me a couple days to polish it up, sir, but
yes, we do.
Jackson?
Yes, Mr. Secretary.
I kept track of our operations in the Pacific. One of my people at TRW, Skip Tyler, used to be pretty good at this stuff, and we looked over maps and things every day. The operations you put together, they were impressive. War isn't just physical. It's psychological, too, like all life is. You win because you have the best people. Guns and planes count, but brains count more. I'm a good manager and one hell of a good engineer. I'm not a fighter. I listen to what you say, 'cause you and your colleagues know how to fight. I'll stand up for you wherever and whenever I have to. In return for that, I want what you really need, not what you'd like to have. We can't afford that. We can cut bureaucracy. That's manpower's job, civilian and uniform. I'll lean this place out. At TRW, I got rid of a lot of useless bodies. That's an engineering company, and now it's run by engineers. This is a company that does operations, and it ought to be run by operators, people with notches cut in their gun grips. Lean, mean, tough, smart. You get what I'm saying?
I think so, sir.
10 days. Less if you can. Call me when you're ready.
Clark, John said, picking up his direct line.
Holtzman, the voice said. The name made John's eyes go a little wide.
I suppose I could ask how you got this number, but you'd never reveal your source.
Good guess, the reporter agreed.
Remember that dinner we had a while back at Esteban's?
Vaguely, Clark lied.
It's been a long time.
It hadn't actually been a dinner, but the tape machine that had to be on the phone didn't know that.
I owe you one. How about tonight?
I'll get back to you.
Clark hung up and stared down at his desk. What the hell was this about?
Come on, that's not what Jack said, Van Damme told the New York Times.
That's what he meant, Arnie, the reporter responded. You know it, I know it.
I wish you'd go easy on the guy. He's not a politician, the chief of staff pointed out.
Not my fault, Arnie. He's in the job. He has to follow the rules.
Arnold Van Damme nodded agreement, concealing the anger that had risen in an instant at the correspondent's casual remark. Inwardly, he knew that the reporter was right. That's how the game was played. But he also knew that the reporter was wrong. Maybe he'd grown too attached to President Ryan.
enough so that he'd actually absorbed some of his flaky ideas. The media, exclusively composed of the employees of private businesses, most of them corporations with publicly traded stock, had grown in power to the point that they decided what people said. That was bad enough. What was worse, they enjoyed their jobs too much. They could make or break anyone in this town. They made the rules. He who broke them could himself be broken. Ryan was a naive. There was no denying it. In his defense, he'd never sought his current job. He'd come here by accident, having sought nothing more than a final opportunity to serve, and then to leave once and for all to return to private life. He'd not been elected to his post. But neither had the media, and at least Ryan had the Constitution to define his duties. The media was crossing the line. They were taking sides in a constitutional matter, and they were taking the wrong side. "Who makes the rules?" Arnie asked. "They just are," the Times answered. "Well, the president isn't going to attack Roe. He never said that he would. And he's not going to pick justices off park benches, either. He isn't going to pick liberal activists, and he isn't going to pick conservative activists. And I think you know that." "So Ryan misspoke himself?" The reporter's casual grin said it all. He'd report this as spin control by a senior administration official, clarifying, which means correcting, what the president said, the article would read. "Not at all. You misunderstood him." "It sounded pretty clear to me, Arnie." "That's because you're used to listening to professional politicians. The president we have now says things straight." "Actually, I kind of like that," Van Damme went on, lying. It was driving him crazy. "And it might even make life easier for you. You don't have to check the tea leaves anymore. All you have to do is take proper notes. Or maybe just judge him by a fair set of rules. We've agreed that he's not a politician, but you're treating him as if he were. Listen to what he's really saying, will you?" "Or maybe even look at the videotape," he didn't add. He was skating on the edge now. Talking to the media was like petting a new cat. You never knew when they'd reach up and scratch. "Come on, Arnie. You're the most loyal guy in this town. Damn, you would have been a great family doctor. We all know that. But Ryan doesn't have a clue. The speech at National Cathedral, that loony speech from the Oval Office. He's about as presidential as the chairman of the Rotary in bumfuck Iowa." "But who decides what's presidential and what isn't?" "In New York, I do." The reporter smiled again. "For Chicago, you'll have to ask somebody else." "He is the president of the United States." "That's not what Ed Kielty says, and at least Ed acts presidential." "Ed's out. He resigned. Roger took the call from Secretary Hansen and told me about it." "Damn it, you reported that yourself." "But what possible motive could he have for—" "What motive could he have for boffing every skirt that crossed his bow?" the chief of staff demanded. "Great," he thought, "now I'm losing control of the media." "Ed's always been a ladies' man. He's gotten better since he got off the booze. It never affected his duties," the White House correspondent made clear. "Like his paper, he was a strong proponent of women's rights. This one will have to play out." "What position will the Times take?" "I'll get you a copy of the editorial," the reporter promised. He couldn't stand it anymore. He lifted the phone and dialed the 6 digits while staring out at the darkness. The sun was down now, and clouds were rolling in. It would be a cold, rainy night, leading to a dawn which might or might not take place before his eyes. "Yes?" a voice said halfway through the first ring. "Badrine here. It would be more convenient if the next aircraft were larger. We have a 737 standing by, but I need authorization to have it sent." "I will work on this end." It was the TV news which had gotten him moving. Even more muted than usual, there had not been a single political story. Not one. In a nation where political commentary often has not displaced the weather forecasts.
Most ominously of all, there was a story about a mosque, an old Shia mosque, one that had fallen into disrepair. The story lamented that fact, citing the building's long and honorable history, and ignoring the fact that it had fallen into disrepair because it had once been a meeting place for a group charged, perhaps truthfully, with plotting the demise of Iraq's fallen, beloved, great, and evidently soon to be forgotten political leader. Worst of all, the taped footage had shown five mullahs standing outside the mosque, not even looking directly at the camera, merely gesturing at the faded blue tile on the wall, and probably discussing what needed to be done. The five were the same ones who'd flown in to be hostages. But not a single soldier was in sight on the TV screen, and the faces of at least two of the mullahs were well known to Iraqi audiences. Somebody had gotten to the TV station, more precisely to the people who worked there. If the reporters and others wanted to retain their jobs and their heads, it was time to face a new reality. Were the brief few moments on the screen enough for the common folk to see and recognize the visitors' faces and get the message? Finding out the answer to that question could be dangerous. But the common people didn't matter. Colonels and majors did. Generals not on the proper list did. Quite soon they'd know. Probably some already did. They'd be on the phone, first calling up the line to see what was going on. Some would hear lies. Some would hear nothing. They'd start thinking. They'd start making contacts. Over the next 12 hours, they'd talk among themselves and have to make hard decisions. These were the men who were identified with the dying regime. The ones who couldn't run, who had no place to run to and no money to run with. The ones who had to stay. Their identification with the past regime could be a death sentence. For many, certainly would be so. For others, there was a chance. To survive, they would have to do what criminals all over the world did. They would save their own lives by offering up a larger fish. So it always was. The colonels would overthrow the generals. Finally, the generals understood. There is a 737 standing by, enough room for all. It can be here in 90 minutes, he told them. And they will not kill us at Mehrabad Airport, the deputy chief of staff of the Iraqi army demanded. Would you prefer to die here? Badrine asked in reply. What if it's all a trap? There is that risk. In that case, the five television personalities will die. Of course they wouldn't. That would have to be the act of troops loyal to generals already dead. That sort of loyalty didn't exist here. They all knew that. The mere act of taking hostages had been an instinctive gesture, and one already invalidated by someone, perhaps in the media. But maybe the colonel who'd headed the guard force over the Iranian clerics. He was supposed to be a trusted intelligence specialist, Badrine remembered on reflection. A loyal Sunni officer, son of a Ba'ath party member. That could mean that the Ba'ath party was already being suborned. It was going too fast now. The mullahs would not have concealed the nature of their mission, would they? But none of that mattered. Killing the hostages would accomplish nothing. The generals were doomed if they stayed here, and martyrdom wasn't exactly offensive to Iranian clerics. It was an integral part of the Shia tradition. No, the decision had already been irreversibly made. These senior commanders hadn't grasped that. They hadn't thought it all the way through. Well, had they been truly competent officers, they would have been killed ages ago by their beloved leader. Yes, the most senior of them said. Thank you. Badrine lifted the phone and punched the buttons again. The dimensions of the constitutional crisis in which America has found itself were not apparent until yesterday. Although the issue may seem to be technical, the substance of it is not. John Patrick Ryan is a man of ability, but whether or not he has the necessary talent to perform his presidential duties has yet to be established. The initial indications are less than promising.
Government service is not a job for amateurs. Our country has often enough turned to such people, but always in the past they have been in the minority, able to grow into their duties in an orderly way. There is nothing orderly about the crisis facing the country. To this point, Mr. Ryan has done a proper and careful job of stabilizing the government. His interim appointment to head the FBI, for example, Daniel Murray, is an acceptable choice. Similarly, George Winston is probably a fair interim choice for the Department of the Treasury, though he is politically unschooled. Scott Adler, a highly talented lifelong Foreign Service officer, may be the best member of the current cabinet. Ryan skipped the next two paragraphs. Vice President Edward Keelty, whatever his personal failings, knows government, and his middle-of-the-road position on most national issues offers a steady course until elections can select a new administration. But are his claims true?
"Do you care?" Ryan asked the lead editorial for the next day's Times.
"They know him. They don't know you," Arnie answered. Then the phone rang.
"Yes?"
"Mr. Foley for you, Mr. President. He says it's important."
"Okay. Ed, putting you on speaker."
Jack pushed the proper button and replaced the receiver.
"Arnie's listening in."
"It's definite. Iran's making a move, big and fast. I have a TV feed for you if you have the time.
Roll it."
Jack knew how to do that. In this office and others were televisions fed off secure fiber-optic cables to the Pentagon and elsewhere. He pulled a controller from a drawer and turned the set on. The show lasted only 15 seconds, was rerun again, then freeze-framed.
"Who are they?" Jack asked.
Foley read off the names. Ryan had heard two of them before. "Mid- and top-level advisors to Daryai. They're in Baghdad, and somebody decided to get the word out. Okay, we know senior generals are flying out. Now we have 5 mullahs talking about rebuilding an important mosque on national TV. Tomorrow they'll be talking louder," the DCI designate promised.
"Anything from people on the ground?"
"Negative," Ed admitted. "I was talking to Station Chief Riyad about sneaking up there for a sit-down, but by the time he gets there, there won't be anyone to sit down with."
"That's a little big," an officer said aboard the duty AWACS. He read off the alphanumeric display.
"Colonel," the lieutenant called over the command line, "I have what appears to be a 737 charter inbound Mehrabad to Baghdad. Course 220, speed 450 knots, 20,000 feet. Palm Bowl reports encrypted voice traffic to Baghdad from that track." Farther aft, the senior officer commanding the aircraft checked his display. The LT in front was right. The colonel lit up his radio to report to KKMC.
The rest of them arrived together. They should have waited longer, Badrine thought. Better to show up with the aircraft already here, the quicker to... But no. It was amusing to see them this way, these powerful men. A week earlier they'd strutted everywhere, sure of their place and their power, their khaki shirts decorated with various ribbons denoting some heroic service or other. That was unfair. Some had led men into battle once or twice. Maybe one or two of them had actually killed an enemy. Iranian enemies. The same people to whom they would now entrust their safety, because they feared their own countrymen more. So now they stood about in little worried knots, unable to trust even their own bodyguards. Especially them. They had guns and were close, and they would not have been in this fix had bodyguards been trustworthy. Despite the danger to his own life, Badrine could not help but be amused by it. He'd spent his entire adult life dedicated to bringing about a moment such as this. How long had he dreamed of seeing senior Israeli officials standing about an airport like this, leaving their own people to an uncertain fate, defeated by his? That irony was not amusing, was it? Over 30 years, and all he'd accomplished was the destruction of an Arab country. Israel still stood. America still protected her,
and all he was doing was adjusting the chairs of power around the Persian Gulf. He was running away no less than they were, Badrine admitted. Having failed in the mission of his life, he had done this one mercenary job, and then what? At least these generals had money and comfort before them. He had nothing ahead, and only failure behind. With that thought, Ali Badrine swore, and sat back in his seat, just in time to see a dark shape race across the near runway in its rollout. A bodyguard at the door gestured at the people in the room. 2 minutes later, the 737 came back into view. Additional fuel was not needed. The truck-borne stairway headed off, stopping only when the aircraft did. The stairs were in place before the door opened, and the generals, and their families, and one bodyguard each, and for most of them a mistress, hurried out the door into the cold drizzle that had just begun. Badrine walked out last. Even then he had to wait. The Iraqis had all arrived at the bottom of the stairs in a tight little knot of jostling humanity, forgetting their importance and their dignity as they elbowed their way onto the steps. At the top was a uniformed crew member, smiling a mechanical greeting to people he had every reason to hate. Ali waited until the stairs were clear before heading up, arriving at the small platform and turning to look back. There hadn't really been all that much reason to rush. There were as yet no green trucks approaching with their confused soldiers. Another hour, it turned out, would have been fine. In due course, they'd come here and find nothing but an empty lounge. He shook his head and entered the aircraft. The crewman closed the door behind him. Forward, the flight crew radioed the tower for clearance to taxi, and that came automatically. The tower controllers had made their calls and passed along their information, but without instructions they just did their jobs. As they watched, the aircraft made its way to the end of the runway, increased power, and lifted off into the darkness, about to descend on their country. Chapter 19. Recipes.
"It's been a while, Mr. Clark."
"Yes, Mr. Holtzman, it has," John agreed.
They were in the same booth as before, all the way in the back, close to the jukebox. Esteban's was still a nice family place off Wisconsin Avenue, and still well patronized by nearby Georgetown University. But Clark remembered that he'd never told the reporter what his name was.
"Where's your friend?"
"Busy tonight," Clark replied.
Actually, Ding had left work early and driven down to Yorktown, and was taking Patsy out to dinner. But the reporter didn't need to know that. It was clear from his face that he already knew too much.
"So what can I do for you?" the field officer asked.
"We had a little deal, you'll recall."
Clark nodded.
"I haven't forgotten. That was for 5 years. The time isn't up yet." The reply wasn't much of a surprise.
"Times change."
Holtzman lifted the menu and scanned it. He liked Mexican food, though of late the food didn't seem to like him very much.
"A deal's a deal."
Clark didn't look at his menu. He stared straight across the table. His stare was something people often had trouble dealing with.
"The word's out. Katrin is engaged to be married to some fox chaser out in Winchester."
"I didn't know," Clark admitted.
Nor did he especially care.
"Didn't think you would. You're not an SPO anymore. Like it, back in the field?"
"If you want me to talk about that, you know I can't.
More's the pity. I've been checking up on you for a couple of years now," the reporter told his guest. "You have one hell of a service reputation, and the word is that your partner is a comer." "You were the guy in Japan," Holtzman said with a smile. "You rescued Koga."
A scornful look concealed John's real feelings of alarm.
"What the hell would give you that idea?"
"I talked with Koga when he was over. Two-man rescue team," he said. "Big guy, little guy. Koga described your eyes.
blue, hard, intense, he said. But he also said that you were a reasonable man in your speech. How smart do I have to be to figure that one out? Holtzman smiled. Last time we talked, you said I would have made a good spook. The waiter showed up with two beers. Ever have this before? Pride of Maryland. A new local micro on the eastern shore. Then the waiter went away. Clark leaned across the table. Look, I respect your ability. And the last time we talked, you played ball, kept your word, and I respect that too. But I would like you to remember that when I go out in the field, my life rides on... I won't reveal your identity. I don't do that. Three reasons. It's wrong, it's against the law, and I don't want to piss off somebody like you. The reporter sipped his beer. Someday I'd sure as hell like to do a book about you. If half the stories are true... Fine. Get Val Kilmer to play me in the movies. Too pretty. Holtzman shook his head with a grin. Nick Cage has a better stare. Anyway, what this meet is about... He paused. It was Ryan who got her father out, but I'm not clear on how. You went on the beach and got Katrin and her mother out, took them out by boat to a submarine. I don't know which one, but I know it was one of our nuclear subs. But that's not the story.
What is?
Ryan, like you. The quiet hero. Robert Holtzman enjoyed seeing the surprise in Clark's eyes. I like the guy. I want to help him.
Why? John asked, wondering if he could believe his host.
My wife, Libby, got the goods on Keelty. Published it too soon, and we can't go back to it now. He's scum. Even worse than most of the people down there. Not everybody in the business feels that way, but Libby's talked to a couple of his victims. Once upon a time, a guy could get away with that, especially if his politics were progressive. Not anymore. Not supposed to, anyway, he corrected himself. I'm not so sure Ryan's the right guy either, okay? But he's honest. He'll try to do the right thing for the right reasons. As Roger Durling liked to say, he's a good man in a storm. I have to sell my editors on that idea.
How do you do that?
I do a story about how he did something really important for his country. Something old enough that isn't sensitive anymore, and recent enough that people know it's the same guy. Jesus Christ, Clark, he saved the Russians. He prevented an internal power play that could have dialed the Cold War back in for another decade. That's a big fucking deal, and he never told anybody about it. We'll make it clear that Ryan didn't leak this. We'll even approach him before we run it, and you know what he'll say.
He'll tell you not to run it, Clark agreed.
Then he wondered whom Holtzman might have talked with. Judge Arthur Moore? Bob Ritter? Would they have talked? Ordinarily, he'd be sure the answer to that one was an emphatic no, but now... Now he wasn't so sure. You got to a certain level, and people figured breaking the rules was part of some higher duty to the country. John knew about higher duty stuff. It had landed him in all manner of trouble more than once. But it's too good a story not to run. It took me years to figure it all out. The public has a right to know what kind of man is sitting in the Oval Office, especially if he's the right man, the reporter went on. Holtzman clearly was a man who could talk a nun right out of her habit.
Bob, you don't know the half of it.
Clark stopped talking an instant later, annoyed with himself for saying that much. This was deep water, and he was trying to swim with a weight belt on.
Oh, what the hell.
Okay, tell me what you know about Jack. It was agreed that they'd use the same aircraft, and somewhat to the relief of both sides, that they wouldn't stay one unnecessary minute in Iran. There was the problem that the 737 didn't have the range of the smaller G-4s, however, and it was agreed that the airliner would land in Yemen to refuel. The Iraqis never left the plane at Mehrabad, but when the stairs pulled up, Badrine did, without a single word of thanks from the people he'd saved. A car was waiting. He didn't look back. The generals were part of his past, and he part of theirs.
The car took him into town. There was just a driver who took his time negotiating the streets. Traffic wasn't all that dense at this time of night, and the going was easy. 40 minutes later, the car stopped in front of a 3-story building. Here there was security. So, Bedrine thought, he was living in Tehran now? He got out of the car on his own. A uniformed security guard compared a photograph with his face and gestured him toward the door. Inside, another guard, this one a captain by the 3 pips at his shoulders, patted him down politely. From there it was upstairs to a conference room. By now it was 3 in the morning local time. He found Daryai sitting in a comfortable chair reading some papers stapled together at the corner, the quintessential government briefing document instead of the Holy Koran. Well, Daryai must have had it memorized by now, so long had he studied it.
"Peace be unto you," Ali said.
"And unto you peace," Daryai replied, not so mechanically as Bedrine had expected. The older man rose and came to him for the expected embrace. The face was far more relaxed than he'd expected. Tired, certainly, since it had been a long day or two for the cleric. But old or not, the man was buoyed by the events.
"You are well?" he asked solicitously, waving his guest to a chair.
Ali allowed himself a long breath as he took his seat.
"I am now. I'd wondered how long the situation in Baghdad would remain stable."
"There was nothing to be gained from discord. My friends tell me that the old mosque is in need of repair." Bedrine might have said that he didn't know. He didn't. But the reason was that he hadn't seen the inside of a mosque in rather a long time, a fact not calculated to please Daryai.
"There is much to do," he decided to respond.
"Yes, there is." Mahmud Haji Daryai returned to his chair, setting the papers aside.
"Your services were very valuable. Were there any difficulties?"
Bedrine shook his head.
"Not really, no. It's surprising how fearful such men can be, but I was prepared for that. Your proposal was generous. They had no choice but to take it."
"You will not?" Ali allowed himself to ask. He shook his head.
"No, they shall go in peace."
And that, if true, was something of a surprise, though Ali didn't allow his face to show it. Daryai had little reason to love those men. All had played a role in the Iran-Iraq War, and been responsible for the deaths of thousands, a wound still raw on this nation. So many young men had died. The war was one of the reasons why Iran had played no major role in the world for years. But that was about to change, wasn't it?
"So, may I ask what you will do next?"
"Iraq has been a sick country for so long, kept away from the true faith, wandering in the darkness."
"And strangled by the embargo," Bedrine added, wondering what information this observation would elicit.
"It is time for that to end," Daryai agreed. Something in his eyes congratulated Ali for the observation. "Yes, that was the obvious play, wasn't it? A sop to the west. The embargo would be lifted. Food would then flood the country, and the population would be delighted with the new regime. He would please everybody at once, all the while planning to please no one but himself. And Allah, of course." But Daryai was one of those who was sure that his policies were inspired by Allah, an idea Bedrine had long since disposed of.
"America will be a problem, as will others closer to you."
"We are examining those issues." This statement was delivered comfortably. Well, that made sense. He must have been thinking about this move for years, and at a moment like this one, he must have felt invincible. That also made sense, Bedrine knew. Daryai always thought Allah was on his side. At his side was more accurate. And perhaps he was. But there was much more to it than that. There had to be if you wanted success. Miracles most often appeared when summoned by preparation.
Why not a play to see if he might take a hand in the next miracle, Ali thought.
I've been looking at the new American leader.
Oh?
Daryai's eyes focused a little more tightly.
It's not difficult gathering information in the modern age. The American media publishes so much, and it can all be easily accessed now. I have some of my people working on it even now, building a careful dossier.
Badrine kept his voice casual. It wasn't hard. He was bone-tired.
It really is quite remarkable how vulnerable they are now.
Indeed. Tell me more.
The key to America is this Ryan fellow. Is that not obvious?
The key to changing America is a constitutional convention, Ernie Brown said, after long days of silent contemplation. Pete Holbrook was flipping the controller on his slide projector. He'd shot three rolls of film of the Capitol building and a few more of other buildings like the White House, unable completely to avoid being the tourist. He grumbled, seeing that one of the slides was in the caddy upside down. This idea had gestated long enough, and the result wasn't all that impressive.
"We've talked about that for a long time," Holbrook agreed as he lifted the caddy off the projector.
"But how do you..."
"Force it? Easy. If there's no president and no way to select one within the Constitution, then something has to happen, doesn't it?"
"Kill the president?" Pete snorted.
"Which one?"
There was the problem. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that one out. Take out Ryan and Keelty would step in. Take out Keelty and Ryan was in like Flynn. It would be tough enough now. Both men remembered all the security they'd seen at the White House. Kill either one, and the American SS would put a wall around the one who was left that you'd need a nuke to breach. The mountain men didn't have any of those. They preferred traditional American weapons like rifles. Even those had their limitations. The south lawn of the White House was thoroughly forested with trees, and, they'd noticed, also shielded by skillfully concealed earthen berms. Just seeing the White House was possible down only one visual avenue past the fountain at the building itself. The surrounding buildings were all government-owned, and atop them would always be people with binoculars and rifles. The American SS were determined to keep the people away from their president, the servant of the people, whose guards didn't trust the people at all. But if the man who lived in that house was really one of the people, there would have been no need, would there? Once Teddy Roosevelt had thrown open the doors and shaken hands with ordinary citizens for 4 whole hours. No way that would happen anymore.
"Both at once? The way I figure, Ryan will be the hard target, right?" Brown asked. "I mean, he's there where most of the protection is. Keelty has to move around a lot, talking to the newspaper pukes. And he won't be as well protected, will he?"
Holbrook replaced the slide caddy.
"Okay, that makes sense. So, if we figure a way to do Ryan, taking Keelty out will be much easier to do on the fly."
Brown took the cellular phone out of his pocket.
"Easy to coordinate."
"Keep going."
"It means getting a fix on his schedule, learning his routine, and picking our time."
"Expensive," Holbrook observed, flipping to the next slide. It was one so often taken by so many people, from the top of the Washington Monument, the tiny north window, looking down on the White House. Ernie Brown had taken one, too, and had the print blown up to poster size in the local photo shop. Then he'd stared at it for hours. Then he'd gotten a map and checked the scale. Then he'd done some rough calculations.
"The expensive part's buying the cement truck and renting a place not too far out of town."
"What?"
"I know what the spot is, Pete, and I know how to bring it off. Just a matter of picking the time."
She wouldn't live through the night, Moody decided. Her eyes were open now. What they saw was anyone's guess. Finally, mercifully, she was beyond pain. That happened. He'd seen it before, with cancer patients mostly, and it was always the harbinger of death.
His knowledge of neurology was insufficient to understand the reason for it. Maybe the electrochemical pathways got overloaded, or maybe there was some editing function in the brain. The body knew what was happening, that the time for battle had ended, and since the nervous system reported pain mainly as a warning system, when the time for warning was past, so was the time for pain. Or maybe it was all his imagination. Possibly her body was simply too damaged to react to anything. Certainly the intraocular bleeding had her blind. The last bloodline had fallen out, so damaged were her veins now, and she was bleeding from that point in addition to so many others. Only the morphine drip remained, held in place with tape. The heart was being starved of blood, and trying ever harder to pump what diminished supply it had left, it was exhausting itself. Jean-Baptiste still made noises, difficult to hear through the Racal suit, the occasional whimper, and the timing of them made the physician wonder if they might be prayers. They probably were, he decided. Robbed of sanity, along with her life, the one thing that remained in her would be the endless hours of prayer, the discipline which had ruled her life, and she'd return to that in her madness because her mind had nowhere else to go. The patient cleared her throat, choking really, but then murmuring more clearly, and Moody leaned his head down to listen. Mother of God, pray for us sinners. Oh, that one. Yes, it would have to be her favorite prayer. Fight no more, lady, Moody told her. It is your time. Fight no more. The eyes changed. Even though she could not see, the head turned and she stared at him. It was a mechanical reflex, the physician knew. Blind or not, years of practice told the muscles what to do. The face instinctively turned to a source of noise, and the eyes, the muscles still worked, focused in the direction of interest.
Dr. Moody, are you there?
The words came slowly, and not all that clearly, but understandable even so. Yes, sister, I am here. He touched her hand automatically, then was dumbfounded. She was still lucid?
Thank you for helping me. I will pray for you.
She would. He knew that. He patted her hand again, and with the other increased the morphine drip. Enough was enough. They could put no more blood into her to be polluted with the virus strands. He looked around the room. Both army medics were sitting in the corner, quite content to let the doctor stand with the patient. He walked over to them and pointed to one.
Tell the director, soon.
At once. The man was very pleased to leave the room. Moody counted to 10 before speaking to the other.
Fresh gloves, please.
He held up his hands to show that he didn't like touching her either. That medic left too. Moody figured he had a minute or so. The medication tray in the corner had what he needed. He took a 20cc needle from its holder and stuck it into a vial of morphine, pulling in enough to fill the plastic cylinder completely. Then he returned to the bedside, pulled the plastic sheet back, and looked for... there, the back of her left hand. He took it in his and slid the needle in, immediately pushing down the plunger.
To help you sleep, he told her, moving back across the room.
He didn't look to see if she responded to his words or not. The needle went into the red plastic sharps container, and by the time the medic came back with new gloves, everything was as before. Here. Moody nodded and stripped the overgloves off into their disposal container, replacing them with a new set. Back at the bedside, he watched the blue eyes close for the last time. The EKG display showed her heart rate at just over 140, the spiky lines shorter than they should have been, and irregularly spaced. Just a matter of time now. She was probably praying in her sleep, he thought, dreaming prayers. Well, at least he could be sure now that she was in no pain. The morphine would be well into her diminishing blood supply now.
the chemical molecules finding their way to the brain, fitting into the receptors, and there releasing dopamine, which would tell the nervous system, yes. Her chest